while oftentimes critically melodramas are disparaged as just being weepy sentimental films or empty-minded action pictures, there's a lot of room there to really tackle deeply complex social issues.
You're listening to the Bright Wall Dark Room podcast, where we belly up with critics, artists, and our magazine's contributors to speak from the heart about film. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Chad Perman.
Chad, how are you?
I'm doing good, Veronica. How are you?
I'm good. I missed you.
I know.
I missed you in our month off.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to see your face after a couple months. That's great.
How's your week, your weekend? How's June treating you so far?
June's been okay. Just really busy all the time. And we have not been in the middle of the heat wave. You guys have all everywhere else been stuck in. So we got our first like sunny summer day in Seattle yesterday, and it was
beautiful.
Got up to like 78 degrees, but it is currently raining again. So
congratulations.
Yeah. We're going to get up to the 80s or 90s this weekend. So I know people come to this podcast for the weather updates. And stuff, and I like to provide those.
The weather segment.
Yeah.
No, it's good. I hate when people are complaining about the heat. I feel like whether you like to be out in it, which I do, but also for moviegoers, amazing air conditioning moment for the cinema.
It's going to hit 90 this weekend, and I'm saying like for sure going to take my son to the Top Gun movie finally, which I know you saw.
Oh, I was just about to try to ask you about it. I saw it on Memorial Day, yeah.
Yeah, and I know everyone at Bright Wall Dark Room has just loved that movie, which... it's rare that everyone loves something. So I was like, okay.
That's really true. That's totally true about the Slack. There's usually a lot more tension.
Yeah. Well, around movies. Yeah.
Around new releases. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. So you were pretty impressed with that movie, right?
I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really did. It's funny because I know when we recorded the Eyes Wide Shut episode, I was really endorsing Tom Cruise and endorsing the sort of sex appeal possibility of Tom Cruise having sex appeal, which I remember was a bit of a controversial take in that episode.
A little.
Now I'm just like, ha, 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 you guys. There's a huge Tom Cruise essence or whatever. And everyone is sort of on board or like reconsidering his, if not sex appeal, I don't think that's the root of it for sure, but just his sort of charisma more generally.
Oh, yeah. I think he has a lot of charisma.
Yeah. I just feel extremely vindicated, which I think is the affect that Maverick is going for.
Yeah. Well, yeah, your endorsement got it on my radar pretty quick. Because I was like, oh, wow, she really loves this. So I got to check this out.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a great male melodrama. Lots of men, lots of unfulfilled potential, partially fulfilled potential, which always gets me, you know?
Yeah.
And that's our theme this month. Melodrama.
Oh, I was going to say that last thing you said. I was like, that'd be a weird theme. But...
yeah, unfulfilled potential.
Unfulfilled potential, yeah. yeah, melodrama is our theme for this month. We're going all in on melodrama, which I am not super well versed in. So that's why I'm really excited. I know the basics about it. And I've seen, it, you know, when I look up lists of movies that are considered melodramas, I've certainly seen a whole ton of them.
Yeah.
But I know that both you and the guests that we're having on today know far more about the actual structural and formal implications of the genre and all that kind of stuff. So I'm really excited to learn from you guys a lot today about the movie that we watched, and to try not to mess it up with my comments about, oh, the movie looks so pretty though, is the main thing I can add.
You know that that's a huge crux of the pod, is talking about like whether and how the movies are pretty.
Yeah, and this one is very, very pretty. We should mention what the movie is and introduce our guest.
Absolutely. Let me do the second of those things. So our guest today is Dr. Lisa Dombrowski. She's the author of The Films of Samuel Fuller, If You Die, I'll Kill You, and the editor of Kazan Revisited and Refocus, The Later Films and Legacy of Robert Altman. She's written for The New York Times, Film Comment, Film Quarterly, Film History, and The Velvet Light Trap. And you can also find her writing on film in Criterion's The Current. She's a professor of film at Wesleyan University, which is sort of the link to how she's joining us today. And for that, I want to throw to our producer, Eli Sands.
Thank you, Veronica. Hi, everyone. Producer Eli here. So I was very fortunate to be Lisa's student through many courses at Wesleyan. Like any really great teacher, she shares her love for her disciplines and fosters critical thought on those subjects. But just as important as how to talk and think about movies, she models how to listen about movies, how to value the contributions of others more than your own, and use conversations around movies, even more than the movies themselves, as points of connection to people both familiar and soon to be familiar. Mm-hmm. Her classrooms are communities of people who care about both movies and each other, and that's why I thought she'd be an ideal guest for the BWDR pod. She hates praise, especially public praise, so I'll just add that I'm deeply grateful for her mentorship and friendship. I am also so glad that she's guesting on this month's episode because her course titled Melodrama and the Women's Picture really revolutionized my identity as a moviegoer. I'm very happy that you're here, Lisa, so welcome.
Wow, Eli. I think that was some of the sweetest things that anyone has ever said about me. I almost feel like I should just give up and go home now. I don't know how I can top that. But thank you so much for putting me in touch with Veronica and Chad and inviting me here today. I am so excited to be talking about today's picture.
Yeah, really excited to talk about it with you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome, Lisa. It's great to have you.
And what was the name of the class that Eli had mentioned? It's something about
Melodrama and the Woman's Picture.
Oh, wow. That sounds like a great class.
It is a lot of fun. And today's film that we're going to be talking about is something I've been teaching in the class ever since the film was released.
Oh, wow.
In fact, there's actually a very funny story about it from the year that Eli was in the class, which if I have time, I'll share later.
Oh, please do. Yes.
Yeah. So maybe I'll just say that our film this month is Luca Guadagnino's 2009 I Am Love. Lisa, I'd love to hear like how you came to the film and how it made its way onto your syllabus.
So I regularly go to film festivals primarily to find movies that I want to share with students. Mm. Most of my focus is on contemporary cinema. So I'm looking for things from the last 30 years, and that means I'm constantly looking for new material as the years tick by. And so in 2009, I was at Toronto, and I saw this on the program. I was not at that time familiar with Luca Guadagnino, but I was a huge fan of Tilda Swinton, who I've been watching mm-hmm. since the beginning of her career with her very early work up to the present day. So I knew after seeing all of her films with Derek Jarman and Sally Potter, I was like, yes, this is going to be one. And I was not disappointed. When I walked out of the theater, I said to myself, I will teach this film. Mm-hmm. I specifically assign it as a presentation film on days when the students are themselves taking over class, mm-hmm. because I think it's such an interesting film to sink your teeth into when talking about melodrama, because it both draws from longstanding conventions of the form, but also transforms them in a way that I think speaks particularly strongly to contemporary audiences.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And I can only imagine for students, that's such a fun opportunity to recognize some of the conventions that you're working on in the class, and then also see those points of divergence and the kind of ramifications of those choices.
Absolutely. Because one of the big questions of the class is just, what exactly is melodrama?
Mm-hmm. That's my question too.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny, by the end of the course, many students are still grappling with that, because there are just so many variations. Mm-hmm. Sometimes melodrama is described as a genre, but I think it's much more accurate to think about it as a mode of storytelling. It's a way of telling stories that can cross genres, that we see in different time periods, in different cultures, and in different artistic mediums, from theater to literature, film to television. So while there are certain formal traits that we associate with melodrama, there's still a lot of differences, and every melodrama doesn't contain all of these key traits. Mm-hmm. So we might think about, for instance, innocent characters who suffer. Mm-hmm. We definitely think about overwrought emotion and stylistic excess. We might think about moral polarity, clear-cut good guys and bad guys. interesting to think about in terms of Top Gun.
Yeah.
And we think also about how plots are structured. Mm. They tend to rely more on coincidence and chance than on causality. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes opens up melodramas to claims of not being realistic, which I think is really debatable depending upon how you define what realism is.
I like that.
And then there are different kinds of strains. So in more action-oriented stories, the effects produced by melodrama are those of sensational thrills. Again, think Top Gun. In more sentimental stories, the effects might be oriented towards pathos for the protagonists.
That's one of my favorite things about melodrama is that sense of coincidence or the lack of necessity of cleaving to strictly logical cause and effect sort of structures. Sometimes this is really loopy, like in a movie like Serendipity, which is like so focused on it, thinking of like if we get out of the elevator at the same time kind of thing. But for me, that sort of argument about realism, I'm not very sympathetic to it. And I just love stylistically and narratively how melodrama just abandons any sort of responsibility to like time and space, whether it's in terms of how things happen or how things look and sound, as we see in this movie for sure.
Yeah.
Well, and one thing that they're going for, which I think is very realistic, is a kind of emotional truth.
Yes.
And so that freedom with the form that you're talking about is something that allows us greater access to character subjectivity and interiority. And that also, I think, is one of the reasons why people have such strong emotional responses to these films.
Yeah,
they're really generated to get us to the inside of characters' heads, how they're feeling, and to prompt us to share those feelings and to root for them. You know, one of the interesting things that chance and coincidence does is that it often pulls the rug out from underneath of characters, that as they try and pursue their goals, they keep getting blocked through no fault of their own.
Yeah.
That allows us to recognize both how characters are stuck with the status quo and the way things are, but we also recognize how things should be, what we want for these characters. We wish for things to be different, right? If only things could change, if only you could get out of the elevator, you know, if only you could get out of town, whatever it may happen to be. That kind of structure allows melodramas to explore not just emotional issues, but really weighty intellectual issues as well, right? Themes related to gender, to class, to race, to sexuality. So while oftentimes critically melodramas are disparaged as just being weepy sentimental films or empty-minded action pictures, there's a lot of room there, if creators want to go there, to really tackle deeply complex social issues in a critical fashion.
That's so well put. Yeah, 100%. I mean, even just what you said about space for characters and audiences to recognize a sort of wish that things would be different. This was exactly what I felt about, not to bring it back to Tom Cruise, I promise we'll stop talking about Tom Cruise. In the last Mission Impossible film, which is obsessed with this idea of like, could things have been different? I'm sorry, things aren't different.
Right.
I love that movie.
Sometimes as a spectator, that sense of perceived injustice is very uncomfortable for me, almost like secondhand embarrassment in terms of a degree of discomfort. I just almost like can't continue if I am let too far into the information and the storytelling so that I see how close they came to getting it right, and then the film is going to make sure that they don't or something. But then in a film like I Am Love, it's not that at all. And the kinds of emotions are made accessible are certainly intense, but I don't know, just don't have the same kind of uncomfortable friction that I feel like some films trade on more to create kind of suspense.
Yeah, and I like the part about that you'd mentioned about the interiority, because that was something I had not seen the film, which we should do a synopsis on pretty quick.
Yeah.
But before, I hadn't seen it until this week. I was familiar with a few of his other works, like Call Me By Your Name and Bigger Splash, but I'd never actually seen this one. It wasn't really even on my radar. I mean, I'm trying to remember. I know 2009 was a busy year for me as well, but I don't even really remember much except for hearing that Tilda Swinton was amazing in it. Mm. But what was so amazing is, and I'm sure this wasn't a coincidence, but she's, I think, one of the best actors on the planet at capturing interiority in terms of like embodying through actions. This was something I know that Ebert had mentioned in his glowing review, that she embodies the actions you can see on her face and in her mannerisms so much more than she can say. And so I think to have a genre like the melodrama where they're mixing kind of the old formal elements of it and, you know, like Lisa had said, something new, and then to have an actress like Tilda Swinton in that role, I mean, I just think it was just it was a beautiful experience to be inside of her head for, you know, 2 hours. Beautiful might not always be the right word. It was disconcerting at times as well. But you felt like you were right on the journey with her. And I just really liked that a lot.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
Maybe a quick synopsis.
Yeah.
Okay. So I Am Love is the second collaboration of pretty frequent at this point co-conspirators Luca Guadagnino and Tilda Swinton, made 10 years after 1999's The Protagonists and 6 years before the similarly lurid summer drama A Bigger Splash. Here, Tilda plays Russian emigre turned Milanese matriarch Emma, a wife and mother whose comfortable life is sharply upturned when eldest son Eduardo introduces ambitious and autonomous young chef Antonio to the Reiki family. Emma embarks on a passionate affair at the risk of obliterating everything her life comprises, not only wealth and stability, but the sort of tender network between mothers and children that we see play out on a few different levels in the film. So we end up with all the kind of hallmarks of melodrama that we've been discussing: generational friction, maternal conflict, romantic distress, overwrought emotion, and early indications of the lush, sensational style for which Guadagnino will later become known. And is at this point, this is sort of the first in what Wikipedia refers to as the Desire Trilogy, encompassing A Bigger Splash and Call Me By Your Name. It's set in Milan in the year 2000 and based on real life rich family, the Castellini, I don't know. How do you say
Baldessera. Baldessera.
Castellini Baldessera family, whose properties comprise most of the filming locations.
Yeah, that was fascinating to read about afterwards.
I know.
Yeah. I had no idea it was all based on like a real family.
There's a lot of really interesting below the line production information surrounding this film.
Yeah.
That is available and totally rich with supplementary sort of insights.
Very rich. I mean, it says, I don't know if we ever pinned it down, somewhere between 7 and 11 years it took them to develop this.
Right.
Guadagnino and Tilda Swinton.
Yeah.
You highlight something important, which is that this was a real collaborative project between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, I read about a decade.
Okay.
In most of the interviews is what they say. It was interesting. I was watching the DVD extras in preparation for today.
Oh.
And they had a behind the scenes featurette, and you could really see from just, you know, the camera observing them as they were rehearsing for a specific shot, how much of a collaboration it was between Swinton and Guadagnino, how he approached her visibly differently than the other actors. And she was planning shots and blocking with him for a number of the scenes that they were doing together. So the collaboration doesn't seem to simply have been one of story ideas, but it really seemed like they were visualizing the film together.
That's beautiful. It makes sense, I want to say, with one of the things that's so prominent to me about this movie is the compatibility between the composition, the camera movement, and Swinton's body movement in space.
Yeah.
Yes.
Even when she's kind of freaking out or seems like she's doing something a bit spontaneous or that she's agitated in some way, it's so fluid and elegant, her movement, and just like completely in alignment with what's going on with the camera in a way that I find just like absolutely mesmerizing to watch.
Yes. Oh. It's a fascinating film for performance because of the dramatic changes that her character goes through.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that highlighted through makeup and costuming as much as the way she physically moves within the frame. So the Emma from the very opening sequence with the long, perfectly coiffed hair and the beautifully done makeup, the Jill Sander dress, that's just, as you say, completely elegant, you know, minimalist, but highly styled and perfect in every detail, to the very end of the film, where we have her with her cut hair, no makeup,
a tracksuit on,
shoeless, right, in the church as she is facing off against her husband and the final decision of whether she's going to leave or not. And you see her stripped down, and it's something that really punctuates this underlying thread within the film, which is who is Emma? Does she know who she is? Does she know what she wants? She's a Russian who was brought from home to Italy like a piece of artwork that her husband was going to Russia to search for, and ensconced in this other kind of artwork, the family mansion, which is very chilly and very severe, not a home of warmth in any way. And as we learn slowly through the film, as she becomes involved with Antonio, the friend of her son, the chef, and who then becomes her lover, Emma isn't even her name. and she says she doesn't even remember her given name. She only remembers her family nickname. And so we start to see these layers of identity peeled away from her character in a fascinating fashion that again takes us right to the heart of who she is inside, what her emotions are, and what she wants to craft out of her life and her future.
Very well said.
I know. Yeah. Just hearing you describe the sort of transformation that her character undergoes makes me think of something I was thinking about, particularly from the opening of the film, but really throughout with the music that's used in the film.
Oh, I love the music.
That it reminds me so much of Jonathan Glazer's Birth and Nicole Kidman as a kind of also really elegant, also really imprisoned.
Icy, yeah.
In a wealthy kind of like environment. A woman who is also kind of this, I don't know, like beached fish at the end of the film. And both of them, especially at the beginning, the sort of austerity and meticulousness of their appearance, it makes me feel like I've never been clean in my life. They are so put together and so just like glacial in their beauty. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, it's true. When I rewatched this with my husband, and in the very beginning, he was shocked at Tilda Swinton's appearance. He said, I've never seen her with such long hair looking like this. She doesn't look like herself, which is interesting because she's such a chameleon in all of her roles. She's so fearless in how she works with the directors to really recreate her physical appearance. But it was fascinating that his first response to her was to feel like she was inauthentic in some way. He'd never seen the film, so he had no idea what it was about. Mm.
Yeah, sort of a funny insight given how performative.
I was going to say,
You know, like trained by manners and convention, her behavior and appearance is at the beginning of the film.
Right, right.
I mean, Tilda Swinton never looks the same in any movie.
Exactly.
So what is the real Tilda Swinton? That's the real melodrama. Yeah, which is part of her appeal for sure. I mean, she anytime she shows up in a movie, the movie gets a little bit better.
Yes, yes. But I feel that we must talk about this house that she's stuck in as well.
Absolutely.
And give people who haven't seen the film a sense of its space. So it is astonishingly in the middle of the city of Milan, even though as you watch the film, it seems like a country house. There's so much land. Mm-hmm. You actually go through a porter's gatehouse before you can enter the property. Mm-hmm. And it's this big marble edifice that was designed by Piero Portaluppi in the rationalist style, built between 1932 and 1935, owned by the families that we were talking about previously. Now you can know it by the name of the Villa Necchi Campiglio. It is a historic house museum these days. If you see the film and you fall in love with it, you can go to Milan and visit it. But Guadagnino had a quote about it that I thought was so telling. He described it as feeling unmovable, like a piece of rock. And that gives you a sense of the weight of the house and that sort of severe nature of it. But also the way that the house, as is true of so many domestic melodramas, becomes a kind of prison for Emma's character. So that in leaving the house, that is actually how she enacts her freedom. She has to move that rock away and get out from underneath of it in order to be free. So it's not by chance that the film climaxes with her literally running out of the house. Yes. And that sequence is so important, as we were talking about, in terms of the evolution of her character, because of how when she comes back to the house and changes her clothes, it's not just a, oh, I'm going to take my morning dress off. Mm-hmm. It's a, I'm going to rip my morning dress off, right? It's like
yes.
The clothes are burning into her skin. She's wrenching off all the jewelry and just putting on whatever she has available. Her housekeeper and friend Ida is helping her pack, but she's not even paying attention to that. She's not taking anything out of the house. It's just like, I am out of here.
Yeah, she doesn't take what they pack.
No, she doesn't take the bag. And Chad, speaking to that point you made earlier about the physicality of Swinton, I love the way she's on both feet and she sort of leans forward and yeah. throws herself into Ida for the final hug. Boom.
Oh, that hug is intense.
Oh, yes.
That's quite an embrace, yeah.
Right, and they're both in tears.
Well, I also like the way that the camera stays with the housekeeper as well once she leaves. And they give you that interiority and sadness as well. Yeah.
Once she leaves. And that's a really good point, because we've been talking a lot about Emma, but the camera spends time with all the other key characters within the film as well.
It really does.
It's not following Emma from scene to scene. Mm. Sometimes it'll follow Emma and then Emma will leave the room and it'll stay with whoever she was with, as you just mentioned in that scene with Ida. And that gives us a much more complete picture that this isn't just the story of Emma, but of all of these other people entrapped in this family as well.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense to me then that Antonio, when we first sort of meet him, he comes to the house at the soon-to-be-deceased grandfather's birthday party and brings a cake because he's just beaten Eduardo at like a race, I think, like a car race.
Yeah. I don't know,
based on the jacket, that's how I'm putting that in. The racing jacket. And he's very reluctant to enter the house, which makes sense in a sort of superficial way, as like, I don't want to interrupt, it's impolite. But, you know, listening to you talk about it and thinking about the way that Tilda described the space as part museum, part prison, I think that reticence is interesting foreshadowing to how the space of Antonio, of their love affair, of everything that he represents, all the kind of wildness, all of that that's reflected in the decision to use two different film stocks to shoot his space versus her space, is really comprehensive in how the film is sort of approaching that difference.
Absolutely. I've spent a lot of time thinking about that decision of Antonio's not to cross the threshold.
Yeah.
Because you're right. I mean, he's asked multiple times by both Ada and by Emma, come in, come in. In a friendly, genuine fashion.
Right.
And he will not cross the threshold. And it seems like a very conscious decision on his part. I don't want to get involved with this world.
Exactly.
And he does, over time, end up crossing the threshold because he comes to cook for the family for multiple occasions. But at that point, we sense he has other motives.
Yes, he definitely crosses the threshold.
He crosses the threshold, absolutely.
Yeah.
But Veronica, I think you highlight something super important, which is this contrast between the world of Tancredi, Emma's husband, and the Reikis, and then the world of Antonio. And it's so emphasized for us visually in the cinematography, in the lighting, in the colors and the landscape. You know, Antonio lives up in the mountains above San Remo. It's wild, it's overgrown. You hear the insects and the birds. Everything is lush and green and hot and sweaty.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
People are always taking their clothes off. It doesn't matter who they are. And it's shot very differently. So you have these long lenses on the camera, which flattens what we're seeing, flattens the plane. The depth of field is very narrow. So you just see little portions of the frame in focus and the rest is out of focus. They're shooting through plants oftentimes.
Yeah.
And very tight framings, diffused light. So it's really sensual environment, mm-hmm. right? It makes you want to reach out and touch the plants and stroke the insects and, ooh, sweaty bodies having sex. which is just the polar opposite when you're in the Reiki family household, yes. where the framings are very distant. Emma tends to be in the far plane or off on the side in the frame. And she just looks like another beautiful piece of art within this mm-hmm. house that's mm-hmm. kind of like a mausoleum. Yeah. It's just all of these things that have been bought and saved and collected over the years, including the bodies of the various family members. Mm. Now I'm getting a little, morbid, but it's not for nothing that we end in another church that is next to a cemetery.
Exactly. Yeah. I loved reading about the cinematographer and realizing, so it's Yorick Lisseau, and he shot so many films that I am completely obsessed with. Like, I love Ozon's 2003 Swimming Pool
mm-hmm. yeah.
another both spooky and sexy mm-hmm. and summery kind of film,
and beautifully shot,
isn't it? Yeah, it's fantastic. He did 2008's Julia, directed by Eric Zonka, which is also with a fantastic Tilda Swinton performance. Obviously, Only Lovers Left Alive, Clouds of Sils Maria, mm-hmm. and Personal Shopper. I was reading around about things that he said. I loved that he talked about Luca Guadagnino as the most technical director that he's ever worked with, at whatever time of that interview, because Guadagnino did not go to film school. Mm. Lisseau went to Les Familles. And so it's just like hilarious to think about Guadagnino being so conversant with lens types and mm-hmm. speeds, and having like a really kind of encyclopedic sense of what technically would produce all these incredible effects that we get. I think also with a pretty like deft hand in this film, like it never feels too hallucinatory or like too gratuitous, but there are some really expressive moments that I just find shocking, honestly. Like for a domestic melodrama, there are a lot of moments when I was watching it.
Yeah, they're stunning.
You kind of like gasp at what's going on.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about the shrimp yet.
Let's talk about the shrimp, Chad.
have to.
I mean, I don't have a lot of insight on it other than to say, you know, what I was worried I was just going to say, it's so beautiful. But that's when something starts to turn in the movie, I guess would be the best way to say it.
Definitely.
And also not just in the plot, but also in the way that it's kind of being shot and kind of given to us as a story.
Yeah.
It's maybe a stretch to say magical realism, but it's like a heightened scene in a way, you know, with the lighting and the, I'd have to watch it again to see all the stuff that they're doing to make it look like it looks. Mm. But it just really all of a sudden just gets really intense and really sumptuous and really just alive in a way that the movie had not felt up to that point. And you feel like both, you know, narratively and visually, like, oh, something is changing here. And then obviously things proceed from there. But I was fascinated by, I think it was Eli who had said at one point, it's a really great food movie. And I looked up Fran's old Letterboxd review from like 5 years ago, and it was just one line that said, show more of the food. Yeah. I was really just hooked at that point. I mean, I was interested up to that point, but that's when I got really invested, was like, oh, there's something very different going on here. So I don't have a lot of insight into beyond that. I just thought it was a fascinating break in the reality of the picture that sent it off in a different direction.
Absolutely.
Totally. What is so interesting about it is how it serves multiple functions, exactly as you just noted. We start the scene, we think that it's about one thing, and it ends up being about another. It has Emma with her mother-in-law and what will be seemingly her future daughter-in-law, Ado's girlfriend at the time.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be a scene about the passage of sort of the crown from one generation of Reiki women to the other. Mm-hmm. They're all toasting the Reiki women. Mm-hmm. But then through initially very conventional means, instead of the focus being on all three of them and their conversation about the role of women in the family and the role of the women in relation to the men, we have our attention directed to Emma as a plate of prawns over ratatouille with a sweet and sour sauce is placed in front of her. And this is a plate created by Antonio. Mm. And then everything changes, as you note, through the lighting. What was otherwise a very conventionally shot scene, the lighting is dropped from both Rory and Ava.
Oh, okay.
So that we only have the lighting directing our attention to Emma. And then we start to cut in super close on her face, on her point of view of the plate, back and forth. And it's all about the sensual and pleasure mm-hmm. of eating the prawns.
Oh, yeah.
It's a scene that Tilda Swinton later described as prawnography, which I think is so perfect.
Yeah.
She was on a roll there, because then another thing she had said, it was in the New Yorker piece, but she had said that they were setting out to create sensationalist cinema.
Absolutely.
I love this thing that Guadagnino said in relation to the theatricality of that scene and of that decision mm-hmm. to craft the lighting in this really non-naturalist way. He says there was a lot of skepticism, but people didn't remember how Orson Welles used light in this way, or The Glorious Age of Innocence, where Scorsese shows the secret relationship by lighting the couple, just the couple in the theater.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's one of my favorite moments, and also a kind of gasp moment in Age of Innocence, when there's essentially this almost like iris in mm-hmm. on the couple that's achieved through lighting as opposed to like masking, and you hear the sound drop out. It's like you really are in that private murmuring moment with just the two of them to sort of really explore the full range of cinematic technique to make that really knowable, familiar experience of feeling alone when you're among a crowd of people. It's so arresting. And that's totally what I was thinking about in the prawn scene, which I also love that there's some kind of squid ink mm-hmm. puree or something, because it's very visually shocking to see this like almost charcoal looking yeah. texture in the food that she's eating too. And it also just reminded me of Flashdance.
What?
Another critical, canonical shellfish eating moment. Okay. Yeah. I was expecting her to like suck the head or something. It was really erotic.
Yeah, yes. It was.
And I love the way that this whole movie kind of displaces the erotic. I mean, I actually think the sex scenes are fantastic just in themselves, but there's so much displacement of eroticism onto like objects and textures and lack of focus. And yeah, so many different paints being used to get us there.
Yeah. And what you describe, and this scene is an outstanding example of it, is an example of what is often criticized in melodrama mm-hmm. As stylistic excess.
Yeah. Mm.
And yet, as you note, it is rooted in something real, which, as you describe, that feeling of being alone in a crowd, right? Mm-hmm. Or in how food can be erotic. Mm-hmm. So it's excess, yes, but it's very much communicating a emotional experience or a tactile experience mm-hmm. that is very relatable and very real.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, those big feelings are excessive, right? Like they're in excess of the kinds of typical baseline going about your day experiences that most people have, but like falling in love, realizing your entire life is a mistake. big experiences that, it's always made sense to me, you know, in a film like All That Heaven Allows, which I was thinking about constantly rewatching this, the sort of insanity of the lighting in that movie and how colorful and intense and indulgent it seems to be, but always purposeful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. Always instrumental, always about visualizing what is typically not just an interior, but an extremely private and almost secret or repressed experience, particularly with regard to women's feelings. And I think that that's just so, you know, as you were saying earlier, Lisa, just like potent in terms of the potential of the melodrama to explore not just familiar circumstances, but really urgent, kind of important issues as well.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Those kinds of overt moments, I think, where the style is very expressive, those end up being viewers' favorite moments.
Yeah.
As you're talking about All That Heaven Allows, those are the scenes we remember.
Yeah.
So this is the funny story I alluded to earlier from the presentation group of this film when Eli was in the class. The presentation group dressed up as prawns for the presentation and wore shrimp costumes for the entirety of the class. I don't know what astonished me more, either the decision to do it or the fact that the costume shop actually had shrimp costumes that they were able to borrow.
Wow.
Multiples.
I hope that was a purchase and not a rental situation.
Exactly.
Oh my God. I mean, you really have to. I was going to ask, I didn't want to get us too far afield before we had gotten to the synopsis, but I was going to ask what it's like to teach this class because, you know, the feelings are so intense and it to watch just like text after text where things are so heightened or so tragic. I was wondering, like, does it produce a kind of intense emotional atmosphere with the students or like in the room in the sort of discussions that you end up having? Never would I anticipate the kind of colorful response that you're describing. Prawn people.
Right. I this is the delightful thing about it. I think some of the classical American women's pictures, and not just American, I mean, if we look at the women's pictures of the 30s and 40s in other countries as well, the endings of those films, after exploring a period of freedom for the female protagonist, typically end up with a restoration of the status quo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think for contemporary audiences, particularly young people who are trying to imagine their own futures, mm-hmm. that can be challenging and at times feel stifling. And there's debate then about, well, why does Stella Dallas have to give up her daughter in order for her daughter to have what is viewed as a respectable life? Or, you know, why can't that guy get a divorce that I have devoted my entire life to, say, in Backstreet? Gosh, any number of them. The differences, I think the cultural differences of the times feel heavier, which is why when we get to the contemporary period and we start to see so many more variations in the forms, I think the students can start to see different kinds of liberatory possibilities within this mode of storytelling. Mm. So when we see Portrait of a Lady on Fire, there is a kind of return to the status quo at the end of that film, but it feels different, I would argue, for contemporary audiences versus looking at some of the older pictures.
Yeah, and that kind of possibility of something like a happy ending or a happier ending,
right,
particularly for these women who are often experiencing liberatory circumstances for the very first time and like a bit later or after having had been more contained. It's so moving.
Yes.
Like the end of Carol always just and how that's also reflected aesthetically in the kind of swimming camera and the score. Like it just feels really fantastical. Like in my mind, I always think the sad ending, the tragic ending is more realistic, but it feels so merciful for film to imagine something else.
Right.
And I do think that we get that in I Am Love, in that incredible frenetic conclusion after she tells her husband that she is in fact in love with Antonio, which is a shocking moment for me.
Yeah.
Yes. It's important to note what allows that moment to happen.
Yeah, we haven't revealed the big spoiler.
are we going to reveal the key plot point?
Oh, yeah,
We usually do that like everything. 5 minutes in.
Yeah.
All right, excellent. This is the thing that I actually think makes this film so shocking. The key obstacle here, as is so often the case for women's pictures where the female protagonist is a mother, is of course the children, right?
Yeah.
Go back to All That Heaven Allows is another example of that.
Yeah.
We have three children, the youngest who may as well be invisible, and the two key children. the two key children, right, are Beta and Ado. Beta is such a role model for her mother, which is a wonderful, I mean, this is another kind of relationship we look to in these pictures, the mother-daughter relationships, which sometimes can be so fraught.
Yeah. Yes.
But this is a delightful example of where they have opportunities to learn from each other. And Emma sees Beta make a series of steps towards independence. There's this little pattern that develops over the film. First, she gives her grandfather a photograph instead of a drawing as the annual gift, as she has never done before. Then she cuts her hair. Then, through coincidence, Emma learns at the dry cleaners that her daughter is in love with a woman. We spend some time with Emma after that, seeing her process this so that by the end of the film, she is following in the footsteps of her daughter. Mm. And in their final silent goodbye, as they're staring across space at each other, there's this possibility that maybe Emma is telepathically signaling to her daughter, mm-hmm. you inspired me to take this step. I hope mm-hmm. my move out of this family can also inspire you mm-hmm. to continue to be so independent mm-hmm. and to make the decisions that you feel you need to. But this is not the character of her favorite son, Ado. He is fascinating and so divisive. I'm so curious to hear what your thoughts on Ado were.
Chad,
go ahead, Veronica.
Did you like him? Were you sad when he met his fate?
Well, I can just say since I just watched it last night, and I've had no time to think about it since then. I liked him as a character. I was definitely shocked when he died all of a sudden. I mean, that was certainly a shock. I also thought he was going to put together when he was coming over to the house, to Antonio's house to wait for him, and found the lock of hair on the ground. I thought he was going to which I didn't want to see. I thought he was going to walk in, or I thought he was going to find him at that moment.
Yeah.
And so then I was actually a little bit frustrated with him for come on, dude, put it together. But of course, the symbolic nature of, and I'm going to say this dish wrong, but seeing that he is cooked, that Antonio's cooked for the family, the Uka. I did get her. Okay. Uh-huh. And seeing, and then knowing, again, back to food and kind of a return to the, or maybe an inverse return to the shrimp scene, where instead of being very sumptuous and changing in one direction and positive, all this just takes the light and blinders off of his eyes. And he's instantly aware. And then it just escalates so quickly. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden he dies. And so I was not expecting any of that. I was expecting this kind of talk when they went outside, that they would be talking for a long time, that they would be trying to work it out, and, you know, it wasn't going to work. But then I also have this bad habit of checking run times all the time to see how much is left in this movie. So I saw that there was only about 15, 17 minutes. And I was like, oh, they're not going to have time to make this a whole second half of the movie where they have to figure out how to make this triad work. And all of a sudden he was just gone.
Yeah.
At first I was like, well, they can't, this is just dramatic. He's going to be in the hospital and he's going to be in a coma or something like that. That's going to allow them to have an affair while he remains in the coma or some awful thing like that. But yeah, then he's just gone and it just dramatically changes everything. So I don't know if I have thoughts on him as a character beyond that he seemed pleasant. He seemed like a nice person. I had a lot more, I felt like I knew him less well even than his sister.
Yeah.
Even because, as Veronica knows, I'm a huge Elliott Smith fan. So to have an Elliott Smith song come in out of nowhere while she's walking through and it guides him through the scene. So I felt like I knew a lot about her character from the fact that she was listening to Elliott Smith. I don't feel like I got as much information on him as a person. So I felt like I didn't have a lot of interiority on him.
Yeah,
that really makes sense to me because he's defined in relation to all these other characters. Mm. You know, he seems to be the sort of person, obviously, who shares Russian with his mother. And they're the only ones we hear speaking Russian to each other.
Yes.
And we're sort of introduced to him through his being named as the co-heir of the company that... whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what they do.
Textiles.
Oh, right. Textiles. Sorry. The factory. Yeah. Textiles.
Yes. The factory.
The factory. And then also as a boyfriend and future husband to Ava, who seems to be looking toward him with a lot of expectation throughout the film. So we don't know as much about him. And it also just seemed very queer to me, his sort of relationship with Antonio.
Yes.
Fixation on Antonio.
Thank you.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. Right?
Absolutely.
I'm glad to hear you say this too, Lisa, because I don't think it's something I would have thought about as much when I saw the film in the theater in 2009, which is the last time I saw this movie. But now having seen it, and having seen Timothy Chalamet in Call Me By Your Name, the resemblance between the two of them is astonishing. Yeah. And I was like, oh, is there some kind of type at work here in terms of romanticizing a certain sort of persona? I don't know. And the source of his perceived betrayal when he does put together that his mother and Antonio are involved feels really enigmatic to me. Mm. Is it that his mother has disappointed him? Is it that Antonio has disappointed him? Is it that is just an unthinkable combination of forces to comprise this sort of larger betrayal? And finally, I thought it was really so fucked up the way he talks to his mother in that pool scene right before he goes in. He says something like, "You're nothing." And then the father says something very similar to her after the funeral. You don't exist.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, we're led to think that Edo and Emma have this like really strong connection. And she seems to think that she can call on that connection even once he's left the table and she follows him. Mm-hmm. That she can be like, look at me, listen to me. Even though he's sort of butted heads with his father in the business context in various scenes throughout the film, it feels like he becomes his father's son in that moment in a way that made me perfectly happy to see him dispatched.
Wow.
Well, hopefully that's not too rude, but
yikes.
Any feeling I had was really a feeling of like how horrible for her to be so involved in this extremely tragic event. Not so much that he's a big loss to the world of the film, but that it would just be very hard to continue as we see it is for her.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that's so fascinating about this is that as soon as we have that kiss between Emma and Antonio at the midpoint, and we have this possibility opening up for her, which, again, speaking of Tilda Swinton's performance, there's just such physicality in the way that she expresses her giggly, almost girlish delight and sense of possibility, limitless possibility, as she's sitting on the toilet. It really invests you in her enthusiasm. But right after that, there are two scenes, one for her and one for Antonio, where we are prompted to think, to recognize how they're trying to process the significance of what they've done and how it might impact Edo. Mm. So Edo has left a phone message for his mother. He wants to meet with her and she avoids him. Mm-hmm. Mm. And instead we spend time just with her alone and we start to think, you know, she's been so responsive to Edo before. Why might she not want to meet with him right now? What is she thinking about? And then we cut to the scene of Antonio in the restaurant where we get inside his mind and we see him imagining Emma coming to the restaurant and them having torrid sex before, poof, Edo walks in and interrupts him. Mm-hmm. So we know from that moment that Edo is an obstacle to the happiness of both Emma and Antonio.
Right.
And that's why I think, Veronica, what you were highlighting with the relationship between Antonio and Edo is so important because they're introduced as competitors.
Right.
They become friends. Mm-hmm. But there's also a kind of frisky physical intimacy between the two as well.
Yeah.
That is somewhat ambiguous. And we know that Edo is handsome, he's gracious, he's honorable, everybody loves him, he respects the family name, the traditions and values, but he's also deeply naive and ignorant about his own family's history, their complicity with the fascists and the Holocaust.
Yeah.
He has little experience with failure or disappointment.
Right.
This is the first time he ever lost a race. So he is like a child.
Yeah.
You know, he's delightful until he's not.
Yeah.
He is the key obstacle for Emma and Antonio. So when he makes that turn, and I think you're totally right, Veronica, to link him to his father in that moment, to Tancredi. It's he stands up, Emma reaches out for him, he moves backwards, slips, falls, and bumps his head on the diving board.
Bonk.
And then that is it.
Yeah.
And it is a shocking moment. And I think you're right, Chad, that our expectation is once we get to the hospital that he's going to be okay. Mm. And in a more conventional melodrama, it would be a moment where Emma reassesses. She recognizes the importance of family. She breaks up with Antonio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what is so bold and so exciting about this film is that Guadagnino and Swinton said, nope, he's going to die. We're going to get rid of the obstacle and we're going to charge forward towards happiness. You know, everything else be damned. And that's pretty bold. It's pretty revolutionary. And so I, even though I think there are a lot of viewers who like Edo and some viewers will be conflicted because indirectly Emma was involved with the death of her son. Mm. But I still think that we're being cued to feel like this is a triumph.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I don't think it's an invitation to punish Emma for being even incidentally responsible or associated with what happens to Edo.
So that was my first thought when it first happened.
Was it?
This is a morality kind of play thing. Hays code.
We're taught to expect that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, thinking about Lisa, you describing him as childlike, which I hadn't thought about and I think is totally right. It also really corresponds with the bedroom that we see Emma go into when they get back to the house, which I thought was really weirdly young.
Yes.
For him, for this man who we'll soon learn has impregnated his fiance. And there's pictures of her all over the room. So we understand it to be a current room, not like a childhood room.
Right.
But it just, you know, from like the little stuffy on the bed to the size of the bed to just everything, the VHS tapes, it feels extremely youthful. And I mean, it is kind of heartbreaking to see her unable to sort of wake up and get dressed and move on, but very exciting, I have to admit, when she makes this confession that we understand is going to change everything. Like, there's no way that her husband is going to say, okay, like, it's a phase, we'll work it out.
Right.
We sort of, I think, immediately understand that this is a grenade that she's throwing into the middle of her life.
Yeah, I mean, up to that moment, you're right, after the news at the hospital, she's like a walking automaton in a complete daze, has to be undressed, is completely immobilized, undressed by Ida, put to bed, and on her son's bed, to your point, Veronica, is a stuffed animal. A man who is about to be engaged as a little stuffed rabbit, very endearing, but still strange, on his bed. And she curls up with it for what seems like days.
Yeah.
Until the funeral. We have an elision of time there, but it seems like she's been in the same bed, in the same clothes for days, until again she's dressed by Ida, but no makeup again, still somewhat disheveled, and goes through the motions of the funeral.
Yeah.
So then we're led to infer either during that period or at the funeral or in the church, the moment when she makes her decision.
Yeah.
And so it is up until that moment, we are totally in a state of uncertainty. We don't know which way it's going to go. But I think Chad is right, is that things progress really fast, all things considered, right? You can imagine another movie that would tack on another act here.
Yes.
But once that decision is made and Tancredi has that frightening line, you don't exist. I mean,
it's brutal.
You can imagine someone saying, I hate you, but from I hate you to you don't exist, there's a big gap there.
Totally.
It almost depersonalizes, like, you're just out.
Totally spine tingling. But it then helps to motivate that sprint to the end that we see.
I love the tension in that confrontation she has with her husband between containment. Like, we see a lot of the camera positioned behind his head so that his head is blocking her facing us, that he's just sort of impeding our view. And I think, you know, to your point that things are really up in the air. It's almost like our access to Emma's interiority, which up to that point in the film has been very wide, is suddenly filled with static.
Yes.
Like, we have no idea what she's going to do next. It's just sort of on pause. But then the camera keeps catching these pigeons, like, escaping.
Yes.
Such a poignant. And I really wonder, like, how long did it take for them to get those shots? Because there's very small windows in a very large kind of dome. But these kind of competing images of escape, containment, I think are so beautiful and really economical for getting us to that point where she does escape.
Yeah, I love the way that you phrase that, these images of containment. And the shot you pointed to, I find actually a very disturbing shot where we're behind Tancredi's head and we cannot see Emma at all.
Right.
He has placed his coat around her, so he envelops her in his property.
Right.
And as he seems to be comforting her, his hands keep wrapping down her neck and towards her throat. There's something ominous about that containment taking place.
Totally.
We hear then the movement of the birds you're alluding to. And Emma turns, and in turning, we finally see her break free from behind Tancredi's head.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to be a catalyzing moment for her.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's a fascinating scene that we can compare with the prawn scene earlier,
mm-hmm.
where there are some unusual choices being made, maybe in a more subtle fashion,
mm.
but also how we're seeing different aspects of film form
mm-hmm.
Non-verbally communicating
mm-hmm.
what is going on with these characters. Yeah. We may not be in her head at this moment, mm-hmm. but we're picking up little clues
mm-hmm.
so that when she finally does blurt out, "I love Antonio," it totally makes sense in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And then we get to the house. And I'm thinking about this thing that you said, Chad, which is that the camera, when she gets up to the bedroom and she's kind of evading everyone who clearly is like, come die with us in the formal living room. Like, get down here, mom. She gets up to the bedroom and Ida immediately springs into action, which I just thought was fascinating and like very moving.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the camera does sort of stay with her breakdown.
And no dialogue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
After Emma kind of has the embrace and then leaves the room and she's just kind of stuck there. And I thought, how fascinating that the film shows that some people will never get out of this house. Like some of the women here will never escape.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought how generous to show that.
Yeah.
Because, it's a pause in what we've just been describing as a fairly frenetic rush to the end of the film. It really chooses that moment to say, hey, let's stop here for a few seconds and see the impact on this woman.
Yeah.
Of this decision that is liberating. You know, so if there's anything unhappy about her liberation, it's that, it's that the housekeeper and her close, it seemed like they were close friends. I couldn't really tell, but they had certainly a closeness and affinity for each other, and that now she's probably losing her one like ally in the house. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so it was a really interesting choice to say let's slow down this rush towards the end and pause here. And I think I could so be wrong on this, and I'll watch it and tell Eli to cut this if it's wrong. Was there any dialogue from "You Don't Exist" until the end of the film? Because I'm trying to think of if there's, like, I can't think of any dialogue.
There's names.
Okay.
You know, there's frustrated attempts to, like, stop the action by getting someone's attention.
Right.
Yeah, because the scene in the bedroom where they're packing is wordless. The hug, the mm-hmm. embrace is wordless.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The very powerful mother-daughter shot at the end is wordless.
Right.
We're projecting or guessing at what those glances are meant to communicate.
Right.
The pregnancy announcement is wordless.
Right.
So that's another fascinating choice, because there's also, I don't remember the exact points, but there was 2 points in the film when sound completely drops out and there's just nothing on the soundtrack. They're very quiet scenes. So that seems to be something he's playing around with a little bit too. I need to see it another time to figure out why he's choosing when he's doing that. Yeah, he uses silence in really interesting ways too, for as musical as the film is. So.
Definitely.
Yeah, you do get the sense that Ava, because she says names of some of the people in the room, she's trying to get their attention.
Okay.
I think to make this pregnancy announcement that is made in the universal language of a hand over the abdomen.
Yes. That drives me crazy.
I was like, oh no, she's got appendicitis. What a terrible time for that.
It's like all pregnant women go around in this pose all the time. It's so ridiculous. It's
really, really silly. And then it's amazing. The camera cuts back. And by that time, it's just that moment of everyone kind of looking at Ava that it took for Emma to really make her escape. And I love that really symmetrical shot of the sort of foyer empty, as if it's a shot of a wall with a missing painting on it or something.
Yeah.
Like there's just where she should be and she's not there.
Or like she apparated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think both of you are highlighting some of the bittersweet aspects of the ending of the film. You know, while we do have this big triumph for Emma, her son is dead. You know, obviously that devastates the family.
Mm-hmm.
Ida is left without a companion. You know, it's she's a fascinating character, the way that they portray her relationship with Emma. Ida is obviously a caretaker, but she's also a co-worker with Emma. They often are in scenes doing work together as well. And so the class issues, both upstairs, downstairs, within the Reiki household are highlighted, but also the fact that Emma was coming into the family from a different class background herself that aligns her more with Ida than with most of the Reikis.
Totally.
But then you also have Ava, who I find is such a fascinating character. Most people don't pay much attention to her on a first viewing, and I think that's because the family is not paying much attention to her. Mm-hmm. But her name is introduced right in the opening scene. Mm-hmm. She's Ado's plus one. We have to change the arrangement of the dinner table for the big party. Mm-hmm. And when the succession plans are unveiled that highlight that not just Tancredi, but also his son Ado are going to be taking over the company, at the end of that scene, we have a shot of Ava taking in the news, and then it's a rack focus, a very overt rack focus to Emma. Mm-hmm. And so we start to have this parallel between these two women mm-hmm. coming into the family from less advantaged backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Ava is described as from the poor wing of a respected family. She arrives for this fancy dinner party in jeans and a peasant top. Mm-hmm. So she visually stands out from them. And we also see her declining wine at mm-hmm. the dinner party. Mm-hmm. Right from there, if you've seen the film once, you already know she knows she's pregnant from the beginning.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And as the film progresses, she's always in the background, on the edges. You know, after her boyfriend dies at the hospital, she's not even sitting with the family. She's not invited in by the doctor. She's not taught the news. So we're constantly waiting for the reveal of this information. Regarding her pregnancy. And at the very end, as she is trying to finally have the big reveal, hey guys, I'm carrying mm-hmm. the next heir, mm-hmm. her moment is stolen by Emma.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of ambiguity to it. Like, is Ava going to become the next Emma,
right.
who is trapped in this family mm-hmm. she doesn't fully understand?
Right.
Or does she know the game that she's playing? Does she understand the world of this family better than Emma did? And is she consciously trying to maybe elevate her status mm. by getting in with them?
Yeah.
There's some ambiguity there. Again, we have very little subjective access to her, so it's hard to tell. But there's the possibility of another tragedy unfolding with another generation, that even though Emma is able to escape, that this cycle continues of mm-hmm. entrapment of women from the outside coming into this family.
Mm.
And Veronica, the way you describe them in that final scene, it makes me think of vampires.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah, that kind of like clan mentality. I love this line of questioning, thinking about Ava's character and what's going to happen to her. I think that question of what's going to happen really hangs over the scaffolded ending mm-hmm. of the film.
Mm.
I want to talk about that, but I just want to say one quick thing that Lisa, your comments about Ava really made me think about, which is how she is styled at the party that ends the film versus the one at the beginning.
Right.
And she's in that like brown, very corseted mm-hmm. cocktail dress with a tulle kind of wrap around her shoulders.
Right.
She looks so glamorous,
mm-hmm.
so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a really wild moment with the camera that I was thinking about a lot after rewatching the film where she gets Ado's attention. She's like, can I talk to you? He steps away and the camera kind of lingers in the space where they were just stationed on a portrait, like some kind of obviously like family portrait.
Mm.
Right.
Seemingly making this connection or suggestive kind of relationship between her and the legacy of women
mm-hmm.
in this family.
Mm.
But as you say, it's not necessarily a positive to be slotted into that legacy,
right.
given what we know about all the pressures that these women are under.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have to talk about the cave.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the cave.
We've gone very linearly, Veronica. I'm very proud of us.
I know. It's usually a little more scattershot than this.
We should have started with the cave.
Yeah. What did you make of the cave?
I almost had turned it off.
Yeah. We're in the credits start.
Yeah.
Right,
the credits have started. And I was like, okay. And then I was jumped actually onto the notes that we had. And I saw Lisa's note about what's up with the cave. And I was like, wait, I didn't see a cave. So I don't know if I would have known it was a cave because I had a really hard time telling what was even happening for a while. And I don't know if that's my lighting or if it was intentional. And then I had no idea what to think other than some version of, I think that they're just happy, blissfully away from the world in this mm-hmm. cave.
It is so mysterious. I mean, I think it's absolutely right to be disoriented.
Okay, good, because I was.
Clarity is withheld.
Right.
The focus is weird.
No.
They're far away from the camera. It's really dark.
Yeah.
I think we understand on a base base level that it is Emma and Antonio. And she seems to be wearing what she was wearing when she left the house. Mm-hmm. So there's some kind of notion of continuity and maybe like a notion of reality. So I don't see it and think like it's a fantasy or something like that. I don't know. I didn't really know what to think about it except until, I should say, Lisa, you were saying the thing about the house as immovable as a piece of rock and that being a kind of conception of thinking about the home. There's obviously something really elemental about this image that the film leaves us with. And if we begin with Emma presiding over the seating chart, presumably a kind of strategic approach to where does everyone belong? Maybe this is the film's answer to where Emma belongs, which is in a cave.
In a cave.
In a cuddling cave with Antonio, just truly starting over, like from scratch in the most kind of base way.
Yeah, there was that embryonic sense too.
Yeah, it's totally womb-like.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I like that conception because some people can have the opposite feeling, you know, that they are hiding from the world.
Right.
Oh. But you can also think of, well, this is a different kind of rock. It's a natural rock and it's a protective space for them. I came to view it in a positive light really after a couple of viewings when I finally connected it to a scene earlier in the film where we actually see Emma and Antonio exploring in the mountainside one afternoon, and they sit and cuddle outside of a space that I believe is this cave.
Oh,
but it's shot from inside the cave out, so we don't recognize it as the same space. Huh. But you can see the outlines of a cave behind them and some trickling water.
Yeah.
And so I am inferring, okay, they're going back to this space that has been a happy space for them. And they're together, just the two of them. And I love this conception you have, Veronica, of the starting over, right? This is, you know, sort of a rebirth for both of them in a space that's their own in the natural world, not in the cold man-made world.
Yeah.
I am so excited to rewatch the film and have my eyes open for that kind of reverse shot effect that you're describing. Because the second that you said that a certain meaning became unlocked for you when you put it in relation to another moment in the film, that's so exciting to me.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
That's why we do this.
Like the idea that there's a logic that can be sort of observed and looked out for. I absolutely love that. And that's very, very persuasive.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons I love this film. I've probably seen it more than a dozen times.
Wow.
And every time I watch it, I will still see something new. And it convinces me, going back to what you were talking about earlier, Veronica, with the technical ability of Guadagnino, the attention to detail, how carefully constructed every moment, every shot is so evident on repeat viewings.
Yeah, I mean, I got that sense even just watching it once, was that there was so much that was that I was not getting just because there was so much going on.
Yeah.
But the one thing on the cave thing, so the earlier quote that I said from the New Yorker piece from 2018, the second half actually might speak to that cave too, because the actual quote is that, you know, Luca and I often talk to forging what I call a sensationalist cinema.
Right.
A cinema you can taste and smell and feel in a bath of environmental experience.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the cave. a bath of environmental experience.
Yeah.
That part's quiet too. I think the music drops out. That might have been one of those.
Well, it's so weird.
Yeah.
I mean, aesthetically, totally apart from everything that we've seen so far, which would make sense.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That we're not going back to anything, but there is a sort of co-created new reality that's on offer. And what we see is like intimacy and rest, which it seems like are things Emma is searching for a lot of the film.
Definitely.
And I know we need to be getting to the wrap-up point, but I did have a question for Lisa. Just this is a broader question, not just about this film. Why do you think melodrama gets a bad rap in so many quarters? Like, to Veronica's point earlier, like, I love that kind of stuff. Like, I love those big expressive moments. It kind of gets equated to soapiness with a lot of stuff, you know? But at the same time, we just ran a piece on Degrassi. yesterday. But where the author points out, like, it is really soapy and melodramatic and all this stuff, but there's also really good moments and points and things like that. So I've just always been fascinated by the criticism of melodrama, or some of the eye rolling, or even the Rotten Tomatoes thing said, you know, the consensus, how they summarize hundreds of reviews into a paragraph. and it said tips into melodrama, like derogatory. And I was like, well, but that's what it is. They didn't tip into it. They tried to make a melodrama.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, as someone who has taught it for so many years, why do you think the negative rap happens?
This is such a good question. It's fascinating because if you look back in time, that was not always the case.
Oh.
If you read trade publications, things like Variety, back up through the 1950s, the films that were described as melodramas are the films that we now think of as thrillers.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Hitchcock's movies, film noirs, because they were utilizing a definition of melodrama that linked back to theatrical melodrama that was very much rooted in action and sensation.
Okay.
Something changes in the 1960s and into the 1970s in terms of how the term melodrama is used. To be frank, I think some of the negative associations with it are highly gendered. I think it's rooted in the fact that you had a predominantly male group of film critics who were not interested in watching stories of sentiment about women's lives. It just didn't speak to them and made associations with what were considered to be lower forms of artistic expression, like soap operas or women's fiction, and use that as a way to disparage the stories, because emotion is not something to be taken seriously from that point of view, right? Or the overwrought nature is not realistic. Of course, this is all hooey, but nevertheless, it continues to this day. And so one of the projects that I have my students do when they look at more contemporary melodramas and women's pictures is to look for that critical perception, and it still holds.
Yeah.
And it drives them crazy, and it drives me crazy too.
Well, thank you so much. It's nice to actually talk with an expert, because I've never understood it. I've tried to understand the rap against it, but it just doesn't. Yeah, the idea that emotions don't mean anything in movies.
Right. I think that speaks well of you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Eli, let's end right there.
Okay, last call.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Every episode, we end with a wrap-up segment where we ask our guests, in this case, Lisa, for the last thing you watched recently, not the reviewing of this film, and then a quick staff recommendation of something that you would put out there for other people to consume. So what is something that you watched recently, and what's your staff reco?
Well, I would say, what have I been watching recently? I've started The Essex Serpent with Claire Danes and Tom Hiddleston and the new season of Peaky Blinders. But the recommendation I want to offer, I would say my favorite melodrama that I've seen recently is actually a series, a K-drama, from 2018, and I want to do a shout out to the Wesley alum who recommended it to me, Joseph Eusebio. It's called My Mister. It's on Netflix, and it has not gotten enough attention in the English language press, which is why I wanted to highlight it here. It's the story of a structural engineer who is falsely accused of a bribe, and the young temporary worker in his office who may or may not be either helping him or creating problems for him. Like an old school melodrama, it has everything. It has comedy, it has action, it has family, it has romance. But most importantly, it's completely unpredictable. Every time you think you know where it's going, you're surprised. And at the end of every episode, your eyes well up with tears. But it's not because you've been manipulated in any way. It's because of honest, real, truthful emotion.
Wow.
You spend time with the characters and you feel like these people are real, and that's why you're so emotionally invested in them. You can relate to everything they're going through. My Mister on Netflix.
Great recommendation. Amazing. It looks like it's just only one season,
but it is 16 episodes, so you do spend some time with them.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for that. I'm gonna check that out. And that's a wrap on I Am Love. Thank you so much, Lisa, for being here with us today. And I know we mentioned up top some of the bio stuff, but where can we find you online if you want to promote her?
Oh, I am hiding online, just like Emma at the end of a party.
Okay. All right. That works fine. some of the things, some of the places that you've written for in the past, you can, I guess, rewind to the beginning of the show. Because you do have some writing online. So.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. This has been an incredible conversation, and I learned so much.
Yeah, fascinating.
Delighted to have the opportunity. Thank you again to Eli for putting us all together here in conversation. Yes. This was great fun. Thank you.
And just a few quick reminders to read this month's issue all about melodrama, visit us at brightwalldarkroom.com. And you can also find us on Twitter at BWDR.
Please subscribe to our podcast. Please rate our podcast highly if you can. Please leave a review for our podcast. Those are the actions that help us reach more movie lovers like you. And the best way to support the show is to subscribe to the site or visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/brightwalldarkroom. Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands.
Bye.
Bye.
But I do want to clarify, you were in the shrimp group?
I was in the shrimp group.
Did I forget that? Oh my gosh, Eli, I can't believe I forgot that.
Is there any photo anywhere?
Yeah, I was going to say, we are really going to need a photo for the show notes, actually.